Okay, so let's go from the beginning of the set. There's a lot in the double Sidrot. So we're just going to pick up on a few points, and I don't think we're going to see any themes in great depth, but we'll perhaps talk about some of the ideas. Let's start off right at the very beginning. Vaydaber Moshe al Rashei HaMatot Livnei Yisrael Lemor. So Moshe spoke to the Rashei HaMatot of Bnei Yisrael, to the heads of the tribes, saying, Zeh HaDavar Sheitziv Adonai, this is the matter which Hashem has commanded. So already, it's interesting, and a number of them, the Parashim, point out that it's unusual that Moshe Rabbeinu here is speaking specifically to the Rashei HaMatot, to the leaders of the tribes. Usually he speaks to everybody. Why in the, and we'll see a discussion in a moment, why in this case in particular, with what we call Parashat Nedarim, the passage which deals with the laws about making vows and oaths, is it directed in the first instance at the leaders of the tribes? So Ishki Yidon Nedel Adonai Hishav Ashvua, so a person when he makes a vow to Hashem, or he makes a promise, le'esor isa nafsho, to prohibit something to himself, lo yachel devaro, he can't profane his words, kuchala yotzim epiv yaseh, he has to do in accordance with what he said, and chazal in the Gemara darshan, lo yachel devaro, he can't nullify or profane his words, but there is such a notion as Hatarat Nadarim, that if you go to a Chacham, then under certain circumstances, a Chacham can cancel your vow. So the first question that exercises the Mefarshim is, why is Parashat Nadarim coming up here? And combined with the question that I just asked, you know, why is it directed particularly to the Rashei HaMatot? In terms of, you know, if we look at Sefer Bamidbar for starters doesn't have a lot of mitzvot in it. It's mainly narrative. And, you know, we've kind of finished, it looks like we've finished the mitzvot in terms of, okay, we had Pinchas, that, and the story with Midianim in last week's Sedra, and we had the appointment of Yeshua's successor to Moshe Rabbeinu in the Benot Slavchad. We had the Korbanot, and we discussed last week why the Korbanot come at the end of Sefer Bamidbar, because they're getting ready to go into Eretz Yisrael, where these Korbanot will be offered up. And now in this week's parasha, we're essentially getting ready to go into Eretz Yisrael. This is the end of Bamidbar, and it's the end of the time in the Midbar. So rules to do with Nadarim would really expect to have found somewhere else in Chumash. And why tucked in here at the end between that the mitzvah of the Korbanot at the end of Pinchas and Saroret HaMidyanim, that's in Parashat Matot. So let's see what the Ramban says. So the Ramban says, Uvar Parasha Zot Mekan. The reason why this parasha shows up here, Mipnei Shehiz Kir Nidre Gavoa, because in actual fact, Nadarim, which are made as promises to bring Korbanot, are mentioned briefly at the end of last week's Sedra. Because in the context of the Yom Tov Korbanot, it says, Levad min idrechem min idvotechem, lo'olotechem, lo'minchotechem, ul'niskechem, ul'shalmechem. That's, you know, the statutory Korbanot are in addition to the voluntary Korbanot that you might choose to bring, and they were often brought at the times of the Chagim. So we've mentioned the concept of Nidre Gavoa, a person making a vow that he's going to bring a Korban to the Beit HaMikdash. So while we're on that subject, Hamar Od Milvad Elu HaNadarim HaNizkarim, that besides those aforementioned Nadarim, Yesh Od Nidre Hedyot, there are also other types of Nadarim which are not promising to give something to the Beit HaMikdash, what we call Nidre Hedyot, a person promises to do something or promises that he won't do something. I'm not going to eat meat, or I'm not going to, in my household it tends to be, I'm not going to eat chocolate. That's, we're not very good at keeping to it, fortunately we don't make Nadarim about it. That's, or I'm, you know, not going to go to a certain place, or whatever it might be. That's, whatever a person says he's going to do, he has to keep it. And to observe everything that he said he won't do. And in all those cases, he's not allowed to profane his words, but others can cancel his vows for him under certain circumstances. But in any event, what the Ramban is saying is that it links thematically with the end of last week's Sedra. The end of last week's Sedra mentioned, by, Levad min idrechem min idvotechem. And so while we're mentioning those types of nadarim, there are also other types of nadarim as well, and we'll deal with them all at the same point. So that's the Ramban. The Baal HaTurim has similar ideas and similar themes, but adds in one or two ideas. So he says Rashi HaMatot, okay, because the Ramban answered the question of why does it come up here? But he hasn't answered the question of what this has got to do with the Rashi HaMatot. Why was the Parashat Nedarim given specifically to the heads of the tribes? So the Baal HaTurim says, Samach Rashi HaMatot Lindarim Davot. Why are the Rashi HaMatot associated with the various types of vows and commitments that a person makes? Dichtiv La'el, again, because at the end of last week's parasha, we had the pasuk quoted by the Ramban, Levad min idrechem min idvotechem, that you bring the statutory korbanot besides the voluntary korbanot that you might commit to bring. Lomar lachan, this is teaching you, Sherashe hamatot kofin lahavi hanadarim vahanadavot. That it's the Rashe hamatot, it's the leadership which has the responsibility and the power to force people to bring these nadarim that they've promised they'll bring to the Beit HaMikdash. Kida amrinan, it's Gemara in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, azhara leveit din sheya asucha. Okay, this is there's a impetus on the Beit Din that they have to make sure that you bring your korbanot. So therefore, the Rashi HaMatot, they've got a responsibility, a special responsibility with regard to nedarim and davot. If a person makes a neder, that particularly that he's going to bring a korban, then obviously they've got the person who makes the neder has got a responsibility to bring that korban. But also, if they are lax about it or reticent to bring it, so then the Beit Din, i.e. the Rashi HaMatot, the leaders of the people, they have a responsibility to come and move matters on. So that's the first link between the Rashi HaMatot and the Nadarim and Davot that the Baal HaTurim brings. He then says, V'chein regalim al pari Rashi HaMatot nikbaim. Second point is that we can regard this this pasuk as being that's a continuation or a conclusion to actually last week's laning, because last week, the end of last week's laning is about the Moadim, that's the festivals and the sacrifices that are brought on those festivals. And they are fixed by the Beit Din. So it's not like Shabbat, which is a fixed seven-day cycle. But you've also got the Moadim, which Rosh Chodesh is proclaimed by the Beit Din. So it's a conclusion from last week. Said this is really the last verse. You can read this as the last verse of last week, Sedra. Vaydaber Moshe Rashem Atot Livnei Yisrael Emor Zeh Davar Shetivah Hashem. Not necessarily introducing the Nadarim and Davot, but concluding that the Moadim are something which are your responsibility, Moshe is saying to the Rashi HaMatot. Va'od, and furthermore, K'she Yisrael B'tzara, when the Jewish people are experiencing difficulty, and we're going to see that later in this parasha where we have the war against the Midianites. So Rashehem Nodrin, then the leaders have to make Nadarim, they have to make various vows. K'mo B'Yiftach, like we find in Sefer Shoftim that Yiftach did. V'chein Sarei Halafim, and likewise in this week's parasha we see the Sarei Halafim, V'nat Krei V'eit Korban Hashem, they bring a Korban to Hashem. In terms of Eit Sarah, a time of national distress, you have to pray to Hashem. Who leads the prayers and who brings the Korban? Not, it's the Nasiim. So the Baal HaTurim has given us various various links there with the Rashi HaMatot and the theme of the Nadarim at the beginning of this week's parasha. Other Mefarshim also point out that Hatarat Nadarim, that's i.e. the cancellation of vows, is done by Chachamim, or by a Beit Din, or by a Chacham. And therefore, this is addressed to the Rashi HaMatot, because they've got to have a particular knowledge and understanding of these laws, so that if necessary, they'll be able to cancel them. We've still got the question, though, that, yeah, we can see a link between that the Moadim and the Nadarim, as the Ramban said, that, you know, the pasuk says at the end of last week's parsha, Levad minidrechem minidvotechem, so then Nadarim brought on that on the Chagim, and there are also other types of Nadarim that a person brings. But this parsha could well, and perhaps to a certain degree, should well have come up earlier. It's true, if it's coming up now, then we can see a link, but why has it been left so long? So let's look for an answer to that at the Abarbanel. So the Abarbanel says, Ein safek, there's no doubt whatsoever. Shekol ha-mitzvot, klalotehen v'diktukehen, ne'emru l'moshe mi-sinai. That the details of all the mitzvot were given to Moshe Rabbeinu when he was on Har Sinai in the first year after Yitziat Mitzrayim. So the only question is when Moshe Rabbeinu communicated them to the people. Everything was given on Har Sinai. Ha'omnam Moshe lo amram miyad kisheshama'am. But Moshe Rabbeinu didn't repeat them all and tell them all over immediately that he heard them. Ela kfi hazman v'hamakom shehaya ra'u eilav k'manik hador. That's umesadeh meshubach. But he communicated them at the time that he, as the leader, and interesting lash on him, Masader Meshubach, I would say an outstanding administrator, that saw appropriate. In terms of Moshe Rabbeinu now decided that this now was the time to communicate these mitzvot. Why did he leave it till now? The notion of hafarat nadarim, of cancelling vows, which appears in this parasha, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't communicate to anybody till now. Because if Moshe Rabbeinu tells them there's a way out of your neder, you just need to go to a gadol, and he'll help you cancel your neder. Moshe Rabbeinu would have had people banging on his door, you know, every day of the week. That's, you know, my wife just said she's not going to eat chocolate any longer. You know, that's, my kid said he's not going to tidy his room. That's, all these sorts of things. People are going to be coming, hammering on Moshe Rabbeinu's door to get the nadarim cancelled all the time. V'hubi yoto hayachid mumche shebedor. Moshe Rabbeinu was the only mumcha at the time, which is interesting. He's saying Moshe Rabbeinu was the only person who was able to annul vows. I don't see why that should be the case. I mean, we talk about the Zakenim. You know, there were the Zakenim, there were the elders. You know, Moshe Rabbeinu taught Torah to Yoshua and to others. That I'm not aware that the Chacham that you have to go to have a vow cancelled has to be the most outstanding scholar of the generation. I think you can go to anybody who knows the dinim. That's, you can go to a Talmid Chacham. Doesn't need to be the Gadol Hador. So I don't really understand why the Abarbanel is saying that they would all come to Moshe Rabbeinu. But that's what he is saying. He would have had sole responsibility and would have had to deal with it himself. But when Hashem said to him, go up onto Har HaAvarim and being gathered to your people, and he's told them in last week's Sedra about the Korbanot that will be offered up after his death, because the day of his death is coming close, so he decided now was the appropriate time to teach the Rashi HaMatot about cancelling Nadarim. Shubachayav hayoseh ba'atzmo. That's what he would have done while he was alive. Hayisharata'am. Lazeh kitava parashasot v'makom hazeh. And that's why it comes up at this point. In terms of Moshe Rabbeinu, now's the time to make people know that you can do this. He didn't want people to know about it previously. So it's a good answer, except for my question. I mean, maybe it's a good answer in spite of my question. I have more confidence in the Abarbanel than I have in my own question. So I presume the Abarbanel would have a good answer to my question, but I've got a question on that Abarbanel. But essentially what he's saying is that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't want them to be doing Hatarat Nadarim while he was alive, because it would have all fallen on his shoulders. Now he's about to die, he had to communicate this mitzvah so that other people would be able to do it.
Is it better to get into the habit of not making unnecessary promises?
Oh, very definitely so. This is, you know, a lot of discussion in the Gemara.
If you don't know you can get out of it, you're more likely to be...
Exactly. The Gemara says it's better that a person should not make a nadir than do make a nadir. And, you know, it's not an ideal situation. You know, that's it. Well, because if you make a nadir and you don't fulfill it, that's a bad thing. So we prefer that people don't make nadarim. Sometimes people do make nadarim, but essentially it's better that they don't.
Also, people may use it as an excuse. I'll make a neder, and they'll like pop up and see Moshe and hear the nadir.
Well, it's not quite so straightforward. You can't just do that. You need to find a petach or charata. You can't just, you know, come and say that I made a neder last week that I'm going to learn. Learn Daf Yomi, and I've changed my mind, right? That's not good enough. That's you need better grounds to change your mind. That you'd have to say that, you know, and I decided that I'd be better off learning Shas Mishnayos first, or that I bought the wrong volume of Gemara, or something like that. So you can't just go and say, "Oh, Moshe Rabbeinu, do me a favor and be matin my neder." Almost definitely not pshat, but a very telling piece in the Sefer Mikdash Halevi from Rav Duna. That's about why this is addressed specifically to the Rashi Hamatot, and it's worth seeing. V'nirel Omar, so he's asked the question, why addressed specifically to the Rashi Hamatot? Seems shebekavanat chila hiskira Torah Rashi Hamatot davka kan. There's a reason why the Torah mentions specifically the Rashi Hamatot here. B'farsha osechet min darim u'shvuot, with the parsha that deals with various vows and promises. Umar midotan ochovotin v'chayimet kol motzafinu. This is the passage which is telling us that essentially we always have to fulfill everything that we say we'll do. Shekein tivam shel rashei hatzibur. This is the nature of leaders, of rashei hamatot, haaskanim, the askanim. Shehem mavtichim havtachot shonot umishunot. Politicians, leaders, they promise all sorts of things. I'm going to take you out of the European Union by the end of October. That's, you know, and there's a certain similarity about all of them. They promise all sorts of things that for individuals or for the country or the community. Even though when they know that they're not going to be able to deliver. They make these promises, empty promises. Etzem hana gahazu, chamura muguna bavadai. And this type of thing, that you just make promises that you know you're never going to deliver on, that is very deplorable. Ulam chamura bimuchad ha-totza'ah hanovat mikach. But it's particular, the results are particularly reprehensible. But he, Shamon ha'am lumeitim mimasehem shel askanim halalu, gam heim einam nizarim daya ha'tzorech b'motzapihem. If you see your leaders making empty promises, so you'll come to make empty promises as well. Lefichach, therefore, matgisha Torah umafhira ki gam, or ulai davka rashe ha'am uman hi gav, muchiyavim laktish sumet leif miuchedet, and that's why the Torah singles out the leaders, that they in particular have to pay attention to fulfilling any promises that they make. So that other people don't learn from them to be misalsel in what they say. Particularly important that a leader understands if he says he's going to do something, he has to deliver the goods. So they should know, the leaders should know, they can't just not do what they've said they'll do. Everybody's got an obligation to keep their promises, but a leader all the more so, because if the leaders don't keep their promises, how can we expect anybody else to keep their promises? I remember that... certainly Netanel, I think also Hananya. They both had these, you know, elections at school for school council. So, you know, they had to write, manifesto speeches. And I remember each of them, you know, in their speeches that they wrote, they were maybe 9 or 10 at the time, you know, I'll do this, I'll do that, a whole list of things. I remember saying to them, you can only promise things that you're going to be able to deliver on. And they didn't quite understand that yet. You know, they thought, you know, that, you know, when you stand for election, just promise all sorts of things. They hadn't even thought about how, you know, which of these things were possible to deliver on. But, in any event, that's,
it doesn't change as you get older.
Maybe it doesn't. That's okay. So that's the, introduction to the Sidrot. Then, the next major theme is the taking revenge against the Midianim. Vayidaber Adonai Moshe le'emor, Hashem spoke to Moshe, saying, the Komnik Mat B'nei Yisrael Meit HaMidianim, exact revenge for the B'nei Yisrael from the Midianim, Achar Te'asef El HaMecha, then you will be gathered to your people, you'll die, Vayidaber Moshe El Ha'am le'emor, so Moshe spoke to the people and said, okay, you know, let's conscript or round up people to fight in the battle. So a whole question about this. This was a very ruthless battle. That's everybody from Midian was to be wiped out. So somebody took me up on this at the Kiddush last Shabbat. That's about the bloodthirsty nature of it. And, you know, that's not just men, but women also to be eradicated. That's, you know, very violent and indiscriminate killing. And the answer I gave, I subsequently saw, essentially in Ralph Hirsch and one or two other places as well, making the observation, I think it's worth bearing in mind in general. You know, there's a lot of commands about war. You know, when you go into Eretz Canaan, you have to eradicate the Shiva Mamin, the Seven Nations, etc., etc. You have to eradicate Amalek, not leave anybody alive. You know, why are we so ruthless here? So it's not just that, it's not at all that we're bloodthirsty. We have to understand that all these nations had a dual agenda against Am Yisrael. They wanted to destroy us physically, but even more importantly, they wanted to destroy us spiritually. And their goal in every instance was to pull us right down. And these were people who were intent on harming us in every way. And therefore, this was a battle for our survival physically and also spiritually. But that's actually not the reason why I brought these psukim. I brought these psukim simply because I wanted to share with you one Rashi, which is interesting in its own right, but there's a particular reason why I wanted to share it this evening. Rashi says, so in Pasuk Bet, Moshe Rabbeinu is told to exact revenge against the Midianim, and then he will die. Vaydaber, and then Pasuk Gimel, he goes and tells the people, right, we've got to go and fight. And Rashi says, Afapi Sheshama Shemitato Tuluyavadavar, even though Moshe Rabbeinu heard that his death was dependent on this, meaning he would die after this mission was accomplished, he went straight ahead with it right away, didn't delay. match, he could have said, oh, well, you know what, I'll leave it till next year and then deal with it. That's because I can delay my death. It's like the story of the three prisoners in jail, on death row. And it comes time for their execution, and they're each offered their last meal. So the Frenchman says, I'd like frog's legs and French fries. So they get him that, and he eats it, and then he's executed. And then the Italian, he wants pizza and pasta. So they get him pizza and pasta. He eats it, and they execute him. Turn to the Jew. They said to the Jew, what would you like? He said, I'd like strawberries and cream. They go, strawberries and cream? Where can I get? We could get strawberries and cream in February. He says, don't worry, I'll wait till the summer. Mm-hmm. That's so Moshe Rabbeinu could have done the same sort of thing here. But he didn't. That's the godless of Moshe Rabbeinu. That's, he went ahead and did what he had to do, even though it was at a cost to himself. Why am I bringing this? Because I mentioned in Shul on Friday night, today, Tuesday, was the Yahrzeit Farav HaMeital Zichron Olivracha. That's my Rosh Yeshiva at Gush. And one of the, I think, greatest characteristics of Rav HaMeital was his ability to see that the task was more important than the man. That's, this is actually what Moshe Rabbeinu is seeing here. In terms of, yeah, it's got a negative impact for him, but the task is massively important, and therefore he does it. And that, I think, is exactly, you know, what Rav HaMeital was. Rav HaMeital founded Yeshivat Har Etzion in 1968. That's, and in 1973, I think, that's, he invited Rav Lichtenstein, Zichron Olivracha, to come and be the co-Rosh Yeshiva. Gush grew to be, that's, I think, the biggest Hesder yeshiva and, you know, one of the most significant Hesder yeshivot in Israel. That's, and Rav HaMeital was somewhat eclipsed in many regards by Rav Lichtenstein. That's, they were joint Rosh Yeshiva, but many people sort of regarded Rav Lichtenstein as being the dominant personality, the dominant voice in the yeshiva. It never bothered Rav HaMeital. That's throughout the years, Rav HaMeital was always happy that Rav Lichtenstein was more prominent in the yeshiva than he was. Why? Because his goal was to have an outstanding yeshiva. And that was all that was important. He himself wasn't important. That's after the Rabin murder, Rav HaMeital set up Meimad. That's a new political party. It was kind of short-lived and wasn't massively successful. That's, but sort of with a tolerant, welcoming religious agenda, which was sort of a bit of a chiddush in Israeli politics. That's, so the first election, Rav HaMeital headed the list. But after that, somebody else headed the list. Rav HaMeital didn't think he was really cut out for politics and that he needed somebody better than him. So, you know, he wasn't in the government any longer. He wasn't in the cabinet. That wasn't important to him. What was important to him was that the political party existed and should be as effective as possible. If that means somebody else is going to lead it and he's going to step back, then he's happy to step back. And I think that's modelled, that's, I don't know whether it's consciously or subconsciously, on what Moshe Rabbeinu did in this parasha, so I wanted to share that with you today in tribute to Rav HaMeital, who I learnt so much from. But perhaps the most famous episode in Parashat Matot is the request of the two tribes that not to go into Eretz Yisrael. B'nei Gad v'nei Reuven, they came to Moshe Rabbeinu and they said, listen, you know, we've got lots of cattle, this is a good land for us to graze our cattle here and our flocks. That's, please, we don't want to go into Eretz Yisrael. Then we have Moshe Rabbeinu saying, listen, you know, you can't just say you're not going to be, you know, everybody's crossing the Yarden to fight against the Canaanim. So you can't just say you're not going to do it. Look at what happened, you know, that's 40 years ago with the Meraglim. You know, you're getting people scared again. And let's just look through the Pesukim. Vayomer alehem Moshem talsune tzadavar zem techatzu lifnei Adonai la milchama. So Moshe Rabbein very famously said to them, well, you know what? If you go out to war, that's before Hashem, and you cross over the Yarden and you fight with your brethren, so then it's we can manage it that way. I saw in Rabbi Shmuel Golding's book, Unlocking the Text, makes an interesting observation about the dialogue between Moshe Rabbeinu and Bnei Gad uVnei Ruvein. He says, a striking anomaly in Moshe's response to the two tribes alerts us to an even more pervasive philosophical divergence between the protagonists in this episode. As Moshe reviews the tribe's proposal to participate in the conquest of the land, he inserts the phrase, before the Lord, Lifnei Hashem, no fewer than 5 times in 4 short sentences. Why does Moshe find such reiteration necessary? Wouldn't one mention of God's involvement have sufficed? If we look back at the Pesukim, you can see in Pasuk Kaf, Lifnei Hashem in Amilchama, Pasuk Kaf Aleph, Lifnei Hashem ad Hari Shoyet Oyevav, Kaf Bet, Nichbisharis Lifnei Hashem, and then at the end of the pasuk, Lachuzal lifnei Hashem, and in the next pasuk, Kine chatatem Lashem. So constantly repeating Hashem. The answer becomes clear upon viewing Moshe's words in the context of the entire discussion. Moshe repeatedly stresses God's involvement in the conquest of the land because the representatives of the tribes in their original proposal to Moshe do not mention God's name even once. The tribes of Reuven and Gad define their responsibility at this juncture solely in interpersonal terms, right? They've said, you know what, we're willing to go ahead of our brethren or with our brethren into Eretz Yisrael and fight with them. In order to counter Moshe's objections to their remaining on the Jordan's east bank, they must find a way to satisfy their obligation towards the rest of the nation. They offer to do so by fighting at the forefront of the Israelite army. Moshe, however, sees things differently. The nation's entry into Canaan is not solely a nationalistic enterprise, but is, even more fundamentally, a fulfillment of God's will. The two tribes' primary obligation, therefore, lies not towards their brothers, but rather towards God. Ever the teacher, Moshe brings God into the picture over and over again, hoping the tribes will come to realize the nature of their true responsibilities. So what we've got here is Rabbi Golden is making the observation that the representatives of Bnei Gad and Bnei Ruvein, they missed seeing their responsibility to Hashem in terms of choosing not, they thought, that choosing not to go into Eretz Canaan was just a problem vis-a-vis their responsibilities to the rest of the people. But Moshe Rabbeinu was making clear to them, not going into Eretz Canaan, not fighting for Eretz Israel, wasn't just a matter of responsibility towards the rest of Am Yisrael, it was also a responsibility towards Hashem in terms of, this is the land which Hashem has given the people. It's not just a nationalistic exercise, but it's also a religious and spiritual exercise, and that's what they have to engage in. Okay, that's the end of Matot, for our purposes at least. Maaseh. I saw on a website that's why I was wasting my time looking at websites is a different question. I saw on a website a picture of a matseva that's where the woman's name was Molly or Millie or something like that in English, and her Hebrew name, it said Marat Matos Masei Bat Reb Shalom. That's her Hebrew name as Matos Masei. If you check the dates, it looked like the dates was she was born the week of Matot Masei. I guess it must be that, you know, they called her Molly and they couldn't think of any appropriate Hebrew name, so they called her Matos Masei. That's somebody said in the comments, that's lucky she wasn't born a week earlier, otherwise she'd have been called Pinchas. That's could have been worse. A couple of weeks earlier she'd have been called Korach or Balak. In any event, These are the journeys of Bnei Israel when they went out of Mitzrayim in their hosts, Biad Moshe v'Aharon, with Moshe v'Aharon, led by Moshe and Aharon. Vayichtov Moshe et motzaihem lemasehem al pi Adonai. And Moshe wrote their origins for their journeys al pi Hashem. Machloket in the Mefarshim, whether it means their journeys were al pi Hashem, or Moshe wrote this al pi Hashem. Ve'ele masehem lemotzaihem, and these are their journeys according to their origins. So the obvious question, which we've discussed several times, I think every year when we have Parashat Maaseh, we address this question, is why the repetition in this first part, in this second pasuk, and why is the order swapped round? If we've got, you could just say Vaktov Moshe Moshehem Lemasehem Al Pi Hashem, that would be good enough. Why does it need to repeat Vayle Masehem Lemasehem? And if it's already repeating, why the first time is it Motzaihem Lemasehem, and the second time Masehem Lemotzaihem? So there are all sorts of beautiful answers, all of which are a form of drash. That's not pshat. I think I've found the pshat. So I found the pshat in the Dat Mikra commentary on Sefer Bamidbar. The Dat Mikra is a modern commentary produced by Mossad Harav Kook. That's in the 1970s, Israeli scholars. I subsequently found this answer given also by the Torah Tumim and the Tosefet Bracha, and somewhere else as well, I think. So it's not only the Dat Mikra that says this, but it's a very helpful answer, which I think is certainly in the along the lines of the Pshat. So what does he say? Et motzehem lemasehem, masehem lemotzehem, motzehem yitziotehem. So motzehem means their origins, where they're going from. Sheinirdaf lemasehem, linked in with masehem. Hachazarot vashemot hanidafim shayachim lesignan hashira shel hakatuv. So all this repetition fits in with the structure of the of the psukim. Aval ashalirot b'sidro shel tzemer milim zeh lo terapeutit greita. It's not just a poetic way. That he says chiasmus. I think that's chiasmic. In terms of the whole way through the masaot we've got. So, you know, this repetition. So it makes it sort of, it reflects it here. Motzehem l'masehem, masehem l'motzehem. Ela mischak milim, l'shon nofel al lashon. That, so it's a particular use of language. Motzehem, shebamakom arishon, lotit parish b'milan nirdefet l'masehem. So it's a play on words. But the term motzaihem, the first time, lo tefarish kemilan yudefet lemasehem, it's nothing to do, it's not a word associated with the word masehem. It's not the parallel or the opposite word to masehem. Ela perusha, what does the word motzaihem mean? Eru ehem, or korotehem. What happened to them? The events. Kamo b'pasuk. We've got a pasuk in Sefer Bamidbar. Eit kol hatzla Hashem tzaatnu refers to all the bad things Hashem tzaatnu that befell us. V'chein v'yisapru lo eit kol hamotzot otam. Pasuk in Yoshua, they told him eit kol hamotzot otam, all the things that had befallen them. V'rabba v'akom Hasheni tiyeh nirdefet l'masehem. It's only in the second phrase, the word motzaihem is the parallel or the opposite to masaihem, to their journeys. V'shiur hakatuv, if that's the case, then this is essentially what the pasuk means. V'aktov Moshe al pi Hashem, so Moshe wrote by Hashem's command, et kol mashekara lahem, everything that had happened to them, i.e. motzaihem, b'masaihem, on their journeys, i.e. all the events that happened in Parashat Shemot, Sefer Shemot and Sefer Bamidbar. And this is the list of everything that all the places they went. So just look at that pasuk again. So Vayechtov Moshe et motzaehem lemasehem. So Moshe Rabbeinu wrote down what happened on their journeys. He's written that down already. That's all been written down in Sefer Shemot and Sefer Bamidbar. Al Pi Hashem, that was written down. Va'ele now, va'ele masahem l'masahem. This is a list of their journeys according to where they travelled from. So this is just this is a list. It's a roster. But it's not a detailed account, and therefore there's no repetition. It's a play on words. Motzaihem l'masahem. The word motzaihem is a play on words. It doesn't mean origins. It means what's happened to them. The second time round, it means origins. It could have said vayiktov Moshe et eruahem lemasehem. Okay, all the events that happened to them on their journeys, but prefers to have this play on words here. Okay, and there are lots of other answers which we've seen in previous years. So very famously, we have that the mitzvah of dividing up the conquering the land of Israel and dividing it up. So it's in the plains of Moab that Hashem spoke to Moshe. Speak to Bnei Israel and say to them, Ki atem ovrim et ha'yarden el Eretz Kanaan, when you cross over the Yarden into Eretz Kanaan, v'horashtem et kol yoshvei ha'aretz mipneichem, you will drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you. And you shall destroy all their idols. And then the next passage, I didn't put the next passage down, but I should have done. You will take possession of the land and dwell in it. So there's a machloket, which we've touched on in previous years, a machloket between the Rambam and Rashi, essentially, on one hand, and the Ramban on the other hand. The Ramban sees this pasuk of Harashtem et ha'aretz yishavtem ba as being a mitzvah. The Ramban, we've looked at this Ramban previously, it's the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, the mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. Says, the Torah says, for Harashtem et ha'aretz, you shall take possession of the land, yishavtem ba, and dwell there. Rashi says, no, it's descriptive, meaning if you want to live in the Eretz Yisrael, then you're going to have to drive out the inhabitants before you can take possession of the land. You can't settle there till you've driven everybody else out. And the Rambam doesn't mention a mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael. So some of the commentaries on the Rambam think that the Rambam holds there is no imperative to live in Eretz Yisrael. Others say, no, there is an imperative, just Rambam hasn't mentioned it for various reasons, because of so many other mitzvot to do with living in Eretz Yisrael, etc., etc. But certainly how to understand this, clearly a machlokah between Rashi and the Ramban, is it descriptive or prescriptive, meaning this is what you must do, or this is what will happen. And then the question of where the Rambam stands. Let's see what Rav Soloveitchik says about it. It's a fascinating passage for reasons that we'll touch on. So you shall possess the land and settle in it. To assert that the land of Israel is central to halakha is as obvious as stating that the Torah contains 613 commandments. A number of published essays have appeared in which the authors averred that living in Israel was not a central idea in Judaism, since Maimonides does not count this as a mitzvah among the 613 commandments. As I said, these speculations are nothing more than vain sophistry. Even if one to maintain Maimonides' opinion, the apparent omission of this imperative from his list of mitzvot does not render it less important. For example, Nachmanides does not count Maimonides' first commandment, I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, as one of the 613 commandments. But he would never deny that it constitutes a central tenet of Judaism. Omission of a tenet from the list of mitzvot does not imply anything regarding its centrality to Judaism. That's very, very interesting. He's saying it's like kind of irrelevant whether it's one of the 613 mitzvot. The Rambam can count it or not count it. Even if the Rambam doesn't count it, it doesn't mean to say that it's not a cardinal aspect of Jewish life. The Ramban, Nachmanides holds, right, that Anochi Hashem Elokecha isn't a mitzvah, but he doesn't disagree that belief in Hashem is a critical, central facet of the Jewish religion. So likewise, Eretz Yisrael and Jewish sovereignty over Eretz Yisrael and living in Eretz Yisrael is a central theme of Judaism. So I'm missing out a few paragraphs, and then he says, the mitzvah to settle in Eretz Yisrael is one of the mitzvot that has not found its rightful place in Jewish eyes. I'm not speaking of the Middle Ages, when travelling to Eretz Yisrael and remaining there was hazardous, as stated by Tosfot. It is not acted upon nowadays because of the dangers of the journey. In modern times, Jews have failed to observe this mitzvah properly. The establishment of the state has halachic significance, since by its means we shall be able to fulfill the mitzvah of possessing and settling it. This mitzvah is fulfilled not only by building up the country economically, but also by our sovereignty there. The state of Israel is the instrument for the realization of possessing the land. So, that's, Rav Soloveitchik's comments, that mitzvah or not mitzvah, that's, we haven't fulfilled this mitzvah properly of living in Eretz Israel. In terms of the Middle Ages, you couldn't go. That's, it was hazardous. That's the journey, the economics, the living there, it was all dangerous. Today, it's not like that. And still, we haven't got, we're sitting here in Chutz La'aretz. So it's, fascinating in the sense that, Rav Soloveitchik wrote this in Chutz La'aretz. Rav Soloveitchik, was a passionate Zionist that's unequivocal here about the importance of Eretz Yisrael, and yet we're not there, and he who wrote it is also not there, and it's, it reflects, I think, a certain complexity in Rav Soloveitchik, as much as the complexity in the subject. I was reading an article about the Soloveitchik dynasty recently. It made the interesting observation that there are two branches of the, there are several branches, the Soloveitchik dynasty. But there's the Rav Soloveitchik part of the family, and there's the Briskers in Yerushalayim, that part of the family. Made the observation that the Israeli Briskers are anti-Zionist, and the American Briskers are pro-Zionist. That's one of those peculiar manifestations of Jewish life.
Did Rav Soloveitchik ever discuss the issue of why he never settled there?
It's one of the big mysteries about Rav Soloveitchik. That's he wrote about Eretz Yisrael. He wrote about the importance of Zionism. That's he never went. That's he visited once in the 1930s. That also was something of a mystery in the sense that even in the 1970s, 1980s, you could jump on a plane, and okay, now you can jump on a plane. Then it was a little bit harder, but not to have gone from the 1930s. I think he, felt he just couldn't, such a tension. That's it's one of the. He was a very complex personality, and this is part of the complexity. Of it all, but Mrs. Lichtenstein, his daughter, once said that in yeshiva, she said that when somebody asked why hadn't he gone on Aliyah, she said he made his kiddush when he went to America, meaning that he was a refugee from Europe, and he'd packed his bags once and escaped and built up a life in America. I don't think she meant that he couldn't, up and go to Eretz Yisrael, but this is where he'd found salvation. For him, he'd been saved by America. That's so he stayed there. Next generation needs to go to Eretz Yisrael, I think. But I brought this partly because of the importance of what he's saying, and I usually make this point at some stage over Tisha B'Av. We have to feel uncomfortable about being in Galut. That's important that we should, but also because just the I hesitatingly use the word irony of somebody in Gallut writing that to that passage. Let's finish off just with an observation about the 42 Levitical cities and the 6 cities of refuge. So Rav Munk, quoting from the Minchat Chinuch, says the 6 cities of refuge are an allegory for the 6 constant mitzvot that we're not to forget even for a moment. To believe in Hashem, to deny the existence of any foreign god, to proclaim Hashem's unity, to love him, to fear him, not to be led astray by the thoughts of our hearts and the sight of our eyes. These 6 mitzvot are, as it were, our spiritual refuge. So we have cities of refuge, and corresponding to them, 6 constant mitzvot, which are a source of refuge for us. They save us. The Tzfas Emet associates the 6 cities of refuge with the 6 words of the first verse of the Shema. And likewise, the 42 additional cities correspond to the 42 words of the passage for Ahavta, which follows. It was previously noted the number 42 also corresponds to the number of stages in the journey through the wilderness and the number of letters in the name of Hashem. So I'm not sure exactly what we're supposed to do. We need to look at the Tzfas Emet inside, see if he says what the link is between the 6 words of the first verse of the Shema and the 6 that are Miklat and the 42 and the physical cities and the 42 words of Ahavta, but interesting observation there. Okay, that brings us to